Greetings, this is James Gillen. I'm your host, and we've got another great show. We've got Charles Eisenstein with us. He's written a book called Sacred Economics, and it covers money, gift, and society in the age of transition, which we are definitely in. And he's a teacher, a speaker, an author focusing on the themes of civilization, consciousness, money, and human cultural evolution. His writings on the web magazine Reality Sandwich have generated a vast online following. He speaks frequently at conferences and other events and gives numerous interviews on radio and podcasts. Writing in Ode Magazine's 25 Intelligent Optimists issue, David Corton, author of When Corporations Rule the World, and they are, called Eisenstein one of the group's up-and-coming great minds of our time. He graduated from Yale University in 1989 with a degree in mathematics and philosophy and spent the next 10 years as a Chinese-English translator. He currently lives in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and serves on the faculty of Goddard College. And we have his websites up there. It's www.charleseisenstein.net and www.ascentofhumanity.com. And those are up on the World Pooja site, so if anybody wants to see those. But without any further ado, I want to welcome Charles on the show. Charles, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks, James.
Oh, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
You know, this is a perfect show right now because people are in transition, and there seems to be, you know, two worlds. Right now, it seems the old world is crumbling, and the old program, which is this pyramidal structure, where everybody is siphoning trillions of dollars off the top, and a new world where it's more of a unity consciousness where people are working together and less focus on material acquisition and more focus on living, you know, in harmony with each other and the planet. In this transition, I know your book covers a lot of this, but you know, what can we share with the people to help them in this transitionary process?
Well, yeah, you know, I talk about the transition on a multiplicity of levels. At the most visible level, of course, there's the transition that the planet is going through just, or that civilization is going through just because of all these crises that we're facing. For example, the financial crisis, but also the climate change crisis or the ecological crisis, soil, water, and so forth, education, healthcare, politics. And so this, I do talk about this visible level and talk about economic systems and money systems, but I also talk about the personal level of transition. And so you ask, you know, what can we really do to help people? Or I would really actually like to say, what can we do to help each other go through this transition? And so what I write about and what I speak about is the transition in our world-creating stories, our deep mythologies that are almost invisible, but that give us the answers to the questions like, why are we here? What is it to be human? What's the purpose of life? What's important and valuable in life? What's the nature of reality? These are actually culturally dependent questions. Every culture gives a different answer to them. And it's these deep answers, these deep stories and meanings that are changing today. And I think that these are kind of the substructure atop which all of our institutions, including money, is built. And, you know, so most people are not maybe going to ever be politically active or are going to want to study money systems and policy and all that kind of stuff. But everybody is going to be participating in this transition in some way. So that might be what's most relevant to people who aren't especially interested in money systems or, you know, economy or politics or
Yeah, that's definitely kind of where I'm at, because I went through, you know, the mainstream program. I used to be in commercial real estate, believe it or not. People have a hard time believing that one. but considering where I am now. But, you know, I went through that whole process, you know, had the big house, the fast car, you know, the, you know, all the things, you know, the boat, that everything you think, you know, to be a success, basically the position, you know, board on the, but, you know, basically, you know, I had a near death experience and realized none of this worked. It's really not why we're here. You know, it's more of a false system that's been put into place, and there's really no love or joy or bliss in it, or nothing of depth, and left that system. So now, you know, I and many others are in a process after leaving that system. Okay, how do we function now on a different level, you know, and still maintain a prosperous life, but in harmony, you know, with the with others and the planet.
Would you say that it was your near-death experience that really changed you, or was it part of other things that were going on?
Well, you know what I feel about the near-death experience is that I knew, you know, I was following my heart as a child, and I was very clear and had a lot of input, you know, and I was always helpful and service-oriented and really cared about people. And then you get that beat out of you through social consciousness, you know, and all the programming you get through school and competing and sports and all the other things, you know, you get that kind of beat out of you and you get caught up in that program. And I think what the near-death experience did for me was to actually break that program. It just totally destroyed that program and got me back to what I knew as a kid was right and correct. Mm-hmm. You know, I also got to see that there is a God, you know, as well. It's not what people think, but, you know, it's not the little old man with a beard and the laptop taking notes, you know, it's way beyond that.
Well, he doesn't have a laptop.
I imagine he could have any laptop he wanted, but, or she or whatever it was. It wasn't even a he, you know, I hate to even say that.
Okay. Yeah. So here, you know, I think that this is something I keep finding, all over the place, is that the transition, when people go through a transition like this on a personal level, usually there's some kind of experience. It might be a near-death experience. For a lot of people, it is. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have to be. But it has to be some kind of breakdown, some kind of collapse of the old world.
Mm-hmm. Like loss of job or
divorce. Loss of job, divorce, health crisis, bankruptcy, you know. Could be something with your teenager, your child. Somehow or other, life has to fall apart before people change, usually. Which is one reason, I think, that has strategic implications for activists or for people who are walking around muttering about all of those selfish, greedy people in their SUVs and why don't they get it? Mm-hmm. Like, what did it take for you to get it? So I think it can kind of... Yeah, it can kind of defuse this judgmentality that is actually very counterproductive when we're trying to bring change to society. Because if we're coming from that place of judgment, then people will just get defensive and actually harden their positions. And I also think that the understanding of how transition happens through collapse is useful on a social, political level too. Because I think our society, I mean, our civilization even, it seems like we could very well go through a near-death experience. We're certainly going through a breakdown in the health of the ecosystem, you know, in the health of society. You could say we're going through kind of a divorce as community disintegrates everywhere. Mm-hmm. You could say we're going through... certainly there's a financial crisis where the resources that were once so easy for us to obtain are now more difficult. And there's all these health crisis, all these new diseases. So you could say that the world's falling apart.
It seems to be an integrity crisis too. You know, you know, this goes off on a different subject, but I think you know, that they're talking about psychopaths, how they just can't feel. They can't feel for another person. They have no feelings whatsoever. And the integrity levels on their actions are just not there. And we're starting to see that implode, you know, at the highest levels where you know, we, you know, I think there's a saying, I can't remember what it was, it's like the sanitarium is run by the psychopaths or something like that. There's an old saying.
Yeah.
And we're starting to see that right now, that we do have people in the highest offices that are calling the shots, that have no compassion, no integrity, no reality whatsoever of any kind of a unified field, and mm-hmm. how we're all connected, and that seems to be coming apart on every level. So it's very obvious we're going to be probably going through some kind of a collapse, either personally or socially, you know, social and economic. Mm-hmm. And I think the work that you're doing is actually creating a foundation. Okay, what do we do after the collapse or during the collapse, and how do we create a different reality or a different world?
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned psychopathy. I've been reading about that and studying that and thinking about that quite a bit recently, for a few reasons. One is that, you can make a pretty strong case that the psychopaths are running the show, but then that framework invites us to basically see the problem as the psychopaths. Mm-hmm. And the answer then is to eliminate the psychopaths or to fight the psychopaths, because a psychopath doesn't understand anything but force. Mm-hmm. Basically, you have to stop them by force. So it invites us into a state of being, kind of an us versus them or a good versus evil mentality, that I think is actually at the root of the problem. So I've been a little bit suspicious of that level of explanation or that mm-hmm. type of explanation. But it's true that our system does encourage psychopathy, sometimes quite blatantly.
Yeah.
You know, it says, I mean, like economics, for example, says it actually has psychopathy as one of its foundational assumptions. It says human beings are motivated to maximize their rational self-interest. That's page one of economics 101. Mm-hmm. So basically it says human beings are psychopaths. Like, what is it to maximize your own self-interest?
Yeah.
At whether, you know, who cares if it's your expense or not? Like, basically they're saying, yeah, we're all psychopaths. And mm-hmm. biology says, evolutionary biology often kind of seems to be saying the same thing. And then of course we have a system that doesn't reward, you know, that doesn't encourage pro-social behavior, mm-hmm. And rewards, like corporations, for example, are legally required to maximize shareholder value, which is measured in terms of money. So if you sacrificed shareholder value to protect the environment or something like that, you could actually be legally liable. Mm-hmm. Not to mention you wouldn't be very competitive in the marketplace. So we do have a system that encourages psychopathy. But I question the interpretation of psychopaths as people who just don't feel. I was reading a book on psychopathy, and at the end, there was a quote from an actual psychopath, somebody who scored very high on the psychopathy checklist. And mm-hmm. he said, no. He said, we're human beings too. It's just that we're more sensitive to pain than most people. So we shut it off and just let it roll off our backs. And I kind of like this idea that some people, because I don't know, when I was studying psychopathy, and probably this happens to a lot of people, you think, maybe I'm a psychopath, you know, and you kind of go back to all those times in your life where you were an unfeeling bastard, you know, and mm-hmm. Sacrificed other people's feelings, you know, and we're all in ego and everything. And, you know, it's like, oh, maybe I'm a psychopath, you know? And I remembered back on those times in my life where I had been subject to various kinds of pain and responded by going numb and training myself not to feel, especially boys, you know, we're not supposed to cry, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So I think, and I wonder, like, if it's just that we're in such a painful world that some people dissociate themselves from that pain and then are able to do things that cause other people pain because they don't feel it anymore.
Yeah, that's a good concept. I know a lot of times in sweat lodges, you know, you'll get people like a banker or something like that, and they come in there or, you know, somebody that's been really, you know, capitalizing at the expense of others or enslaving others or whatever. And they come in there and they have a total breakdown. And you find out basically all they are is just a wounded little boy trying to impress their father, you know, there's some program in there that's running that allows them to do those things that they don't, they just don't, they haven't taken the time to do their own inner healing, you know, or work with any kind of process-oriented therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So James, did we have a topic for today? I mean, this is fun.
Yeah, just flow wherever it goes. Okay. I was going to share one thing. I was at a place called, I believe it's Tassajara, and it's a Zen monastery, basically. And they have a place where there's a river, you know, and a hot springs flowing into the river, and beautiful saunas and everything else. And everybody goes down to this river, and it's a huge water slide. And people slide down this water, land in this big pond. You know, it's just a beautiful place. And what's interesting is you go there, well, everybody's pretty much naked, you know. It's But when you go there, you look at everybody there, and there's, you know, skinny people, heavy people, you know, black people, oriental people, white people, you know, every color, every size, everything you can imagine. And everybody is sliding off this thing, going into the off the waterfall, standing around, you know, communicating, you know, there's no divisions there, really. I mean, it was amazing. And I was observing this, and I saw this man come up, and he, you know, he looked like he came straight out of a boardroom, basically. And I think his daughter brought him there. And he stood there, and it looked like he was having a heart attack.
Wow.
Watching the people. And this friend of mine was going to jump up and help him. And I said, no, don't. I said, just leave him alone right now. He's having a heart opening. He's not having a heart attack.
Yeah.
And he's having a big reality check on his whole life was pretty much, in a way, wasted because, you know, he's running a program that is totally dysfunctional, no love, no joy, no unity, you know, nothing in it. And walking into this reality, he just had basically a meltdown. And then finally this woman I was with, she went up to him and said, "Are you all right? Are you okay?" And he goes, "Yeah." He goes, "I just realized I wasted, you know, the vast majority of my life. And this is what's really important." So he had a total meltdown. And that's what I see, is that there's people that are just caught up in a program and a reality or their small world, you know, in their cubicle and day-to-day stuff. And they haven't really been to a place where there is a template of people all, you know, hanging out in harmony, every race, every color, every size, you know, everybody just having fun, you know,
People playing, people not being in a hurry, people just enjoying being with each other. Like, all that stuff is so available.
And I think that's where we're going. That's the world we're going towards. But the old world, I think, as you're saying, it may have to collapse. You know, it's in a process of collapse for the new world to come in.
And I think that's why it's, you know, I was talking about judgmentality, and I think that's why it's really counterproductive to frame what's going on today as, for example, the 99% versus the 1%, because it's not working for the 1% either.
Yeah, it definitely isn't.
And this is something that triggers people sometimes. They say, "Come on, Charles, how can you say that it's not working for the 1%? They're the ones with the 100-foot yacht, you know, and all of these, the 10,000 square foot house and the six cars, it's obviously working for them. But I think that those things are, those are kind of substitutes for the scene that you were just describing. Mm-hmm. You know, people playing out in nature all together at ease. If you don't have that, then you're going to try to compensate by adding all of these things that you really don't need as a substitute for what you really do need.
Yeah, it does seem to be, too, is when you have all those substitutes, you know, like the giant house and all the cars and the yacht and everything else, you're trapped. Those things own you. That's what I realized when I had the near-death experience. I go, I don't own these things. They own me. And I have to keep up this outer appearance for my ego to think I'm special or I'm the upper crust or whatever, you know. And I really realized I wasn't free at all and that these things own me. I didn't own them.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I want to also, you know, make it clear that I'm not saying, oh, that, you know, poor people should, in some sense, should be happy because people really are facing very hard circumstances. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't remember the statistic, but I mean, some huge percentage of children in America go to bed hungry, at least sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, like we can't minimize that.
No.
But that hunger is a consequence of our system. It's not because of any fundamental scarcity in the world. Mm-hmm. We waste vast amounts of food, and our biggest crop in America is lawn grass.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's. I mean, I've talked about this before, but I saw mountains of corn and wheat and things like that. I mean, literally mountains that were pushed aside because they wanted to keep the market up. They had just bumper crops, and they go, well, we have to just dump this. And continue with kind of a scarcity program so we can keep the market up. And I couldn't believe it. I said, oh, my God, that would feed the world, basically.
Yeah.
All we need to do is figure out a way to transport it and turn some of our assets into, you know, getting this out, you know, to people in need. But again, you know, most of the assets are going into the war industry or you know, trillions of dollars going into these crazy wars and these other programs that really serve nobody other than, you know, the people building the war toys and the people, you know, looking to grab, you know, other people's resources, basically.
Or they're going toward, you know, sprawling suburbs and fast cars and huge houses and all these other things that don't really serve human happiness in any way.
I don't think they're healthy at all. That lifestyle, especially when you put people right next to each other in little cubicles, the psychic turbulence in that apartment complex, when you are sensitive, is really tough on you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you don't have a place in nature you can go out and expand and relax and it's just not a healthy way of being.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was mentioning that, like, the underlying abundance that's beneath the scarcity that we experience. The reason I thought of that is because it's kind of similar to the scene that you described with all those people outside, you know, playing in the river, that a more beautiful world is not very far away. Mm-hmm. It's only our perceptions and our habits that are in the way, that, you know, between us and that more beautiful world. And it's simply a matter of maybe sometimes just, you know, taking off our clothes and getting into the water, you know, and we've been, that's in my other book, The Ascent of Humanity, the image on the cover is a painting of the Tower of Babel, which I see as a metaphor for the attempt to attain heaven through working really hard to get there. Because for so long, humanity has thought, or you know, at least Western civilization has been under the operating assumption that if we only complete our conquest of nature and bend matter to our will through technology, that we'll have a better and better world and someday a perfect world. and you know, starting with the steam engine and electricity and atomic power and the computer and nanotechnology and medical miracles, and life is getting better and better, and someday our control over matter will be complete and we'll live in a utopia. And so it's just a matter of a few more inventions maybe, and a little bit more data input to get everything computerized, and then we'll have this age of leisure and joy and abundance and all these good things that have actually been available already all the time. Just like when you had your near-death experience, you know, and you realized that happiness was already right in front of your face all the time. And so I think, you know, here we are building this tower to heaven and laboring really hard to get there, sometimes looking up and thinking, well, yeah, maybe we're a little closer to the sky than when we started. Yeah. But of course we're not, you know. Of course, no matter how high you build, the sky is still
there.
You could never get there. Yeah. And we're reaching the point now where we're just getting exhausted from this tower building, and the tower is beginning to crumble. And we're just, more and more people are kind of pausing.
Yeah, the people holding up that tower are the people needed to maintain that tower are walking away. So
that's right. Yeah. They're walking away because they see like that the sky actually starts an inch off the ground. Yeah. We're already there.
Yeah.
You know, and so they're taking off their clothes and jumping into the river. And they're like, we're already there.
Yeah.
And I think that one way that shows up is that people are getting less and less enthusiastic about participating in the system. Mm-hmm. A couple generations ago, people were very enthusiastic about joining the machine, you know, to somebody who is maybe intellectually oriented would definitely want to become a professor. And because they really believed in the institution of academia, it wasn't just that it was job security, but they really believed in this program where you wanted to become a scientist of some sort or an engineer. You know, kids in the 1940s and 1950s, they wanted to be engineers. Mm-hmm. And today, people don't have that kind of buy-in, that kind of enthusiasm for the project of technology. And the best and brightest are often kind of just stepping away from the whole thing. In my generation, we became slackers, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like the best and brightest are always snagged up for the war industry, or, you know, to create weapons of mass destruction, you know, in a lot of different levels. It's kind of amazing. But the, you know, what I see is that, you know, there is this group, this corporate elite, whatever you want to call it, you know, that have these concepts of, you know, eugenics. We have to get down the population. They have a program of transhuman, you know, beliefs that we're going to, you know, we're going to become basically synthetic robots or whatever. You know, they have all these programs that are running, and they don't realize that you know, nature isn't broke. You know, nature is one of the best programs you can ever get. And why would you want to get away from, you know, having a wholesome, you know, a spiritually loving, wholesome life, you know, and living in harmony with each other in nature. And the other thing too, as I see too, is that, and I've worked with scientists. I'm privy to some things out there that, you know, we have the ability to heal almost every disease, including every cancer you can think of through certain formulas and energy devices. You know, we have the ability. We have counter gravity. We have anti gravity. We have the ability to jump dimensions. You know, in the Black Projects, we have the things for utopia. And you know, we have Earth-friendly technologies that we could use to cover all of our energy needs and transportation needs. But, you know, this is all being withheld by this group, you know, this elite group, you might say. I know it's starting to bust out. It's going to bust out all over anyway. It's going to come out. But, you know, as we were talking before, when I see mountains and mountains of corn and wheat sitting there, and when you add some kind of a transportation device that's fuelless, you know, they could transport them anywhere, anytime. Bang! There's your hunger problem solved. You know, basically.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of skeptical, actually. I'm a little skeptical of that. I think that view buys in a little bit to this kind of technology is our savior. Mm-hmm. You know, when I think about solving the hunger problem, I'm thinking more, you know, I'm not thinking in terms of mountains of grain flowing around the world with fuelless devices. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking more of like re-empowering local subsistence agriculture, where people are getting back into a direct relationship to the land.
Oh, I agree. That's exactly what we promote here. And but I was just using that as an example.
Yeah.
If we put our resources towards ending hunger or poverty or whatever, we could do it in a heartbeat, in a moment. Mm-hmm. But as you're saying, I think it does begin with the individual and learning how to create, you know, and manifest from your own center versus creating another dependency.
That's one way to look at it. I'm not sure though, really, if you can. Yeah, I mean, it can be very empowering to say it is all about the individual and manifesting and changing yourself, and by changing yourself, you'll change the world. So focus within. That can be empowering, but also it can be kind of an escape mm-hmm. from this really necessary, beautiful, and ultimately fun work
exactly.
to do in the world.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I write about is the change in the human sense of self, in our identity. I was talking about those world-defining stories, and one of them is the story of self that says who you are. And it says what we've lived under is a story of self that says what you are is this kind of skin encapsulated spirit or soul uh-huh. or consciousness or mind that's separate from the flesh, separate from other skin encapsulated souls, separate from the universe. So you're this bubble of psychology walking around an objective universe. And the teaching that your reality reflects your beliefs, for example, which is kind of a very New Agey teaching, mm-hmm. that's a step in the right direction, because it says that it's not just this external objective universe out there, but mm-hmm. it's somehow a mirror of yourself. That's a step in the right direction. But I think a further step in that right direction is to recognize that, okay, changing yourself is not separate from changing the world in the opposite way either. Mm-hmm. And that the way to work on yourself is through your relationships to other people and to other beings and to the world, because you aren't this discrete, separate person, but you are actually the sum total of all of your relationships. Like, you are a relationship, mm-hmm. not a separate being having relationships, but you are a relationship. And this is kind of the foundation of all my books, like mm-hmm. economics, for example, if you are a relationship, then a different kind of economic system arises very naturally, and a different set of motivations that's very congruent to what hunter-gatherers practiced. Because mm-hmm. in a hunter-gatherer system, okay, well, yeah, you can break in.
Yeah, I've got a question. No, so anyway, like, having, you know, the center here for like 25 years, we've had some real tests, you know, on mm-hmm. every level, and working with trying to create a format or a foundation or whatever that doesn't really fit into the world as it is now, and trying to create a whole new template or a whole new reality, mm-hmm. and it's really challenging, because you have to have that within. To do it, you know, you have to kind of work on that program within yourself first, or you're not going to do it in the outer world. So, uh-huh. so, you know, we'll have people come, one person will come, and they'll have a real sense of entitlement, and uh-huh. they think everything is supposed to be provided for them, and they don't really have to do anything other than sit around and play their flute or drums, you know. Uh-huh. You know, another person will come in and just work really hard, and then you know, build up resentment because they aren't, you know, the other person is sitting there playing the flute, you know, and right. It's really interesting dynamics. And it's, and, you know, there's a lot of people that, let's say they've been raised in an affluent family and, you know, all their food, everything was always provided for them. And they have that expectation, that room and board and food and utilities, everything is going to be covered. Uh-huh. And that's the new world, you know, and so you have all these dynamics, you know, coming together. What's so interesting is you know, putting together a group consciousness where everybody agrees, but all also remain flexible, you know, for you know, personal experiences and things like that, or personal evolution. It's a real tricky process, you know, putting something together like this.
Yeah, because you're trying to recreate something that evolved over centuries and millennia in traditional mm-hmm. cultures. And so you're bringing people together who don't have these traditional ways of cooperating and sharing and interacting and enforcing pro-social behavior. And so you're trying to recreate it from scratch with people coming in from a monetized world where essentially you pay for everything mm-hmm. and you don't do anything for anybody else unless you're being paid to do it, which is an exaggeration. People still do things for each other, mm-hmm. But less than they did a generation ago. That's for sure.
Oh yeah.
You know, as far as just like what neighbors do for each other.
Yeah. People don't even know their neighbors anymore.
People don't even know their neighbors. Yeah. But in traditional suburbia, like in the '50s, for example, if you were doing some kind of project in your yard, or you were, you know, putting on a new roof or something like that, your neighbors would come over and help. Mm-hmm. Like neighbors helped each other out, and oh, yeah. We don't have that anymore. So it's I've been trying to navigate this territory as well. As I, you know, when I go around and speak and I do events based on gift principles, and just watching all that comes up in people, or that comes up in me also when I interact with people. It's been quite a learning curve, and I think it's just, it's important, you know, that we're trying stuff out and developing ways of relating to each other and ways of serving each other that are based on our understanding of ourselves as connected beings and our, you know, and as being one with the universe, because mm-hmm. the money system denies that. The money system keeps us separate and puts us into competition whether we want to be or not. Mm-hmm. You can swim against the current, but the current is toward atomization, toward separation, toward mm-hmm. competition.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's tricky because you'll have one person, like I said, one person will come and they'll say, hey, I made $50,000, $75,000 a year, mm-hmm. You know, and they'll come up and they'll say, do you have a position for me? You know, I need this and this and this, you know, uh-huh. And then another person says, hey, I just want to come and help. You know, yeah. I love what you're doing. I really believe in what you're doing. I just want to see this. This is so necessary. I want to see this happen. And those are two extremes. And then you have people in the middle saying, hey, you know, let's all work together and enjoy the fruits of our labor and shift into, creationary mind and service oriented and things like that. And really focus on creating abundance here. That actually works really well, you know, it flows really well, but then you have all these other distortions in the field, you know, the field of consciousness there that are still playing out the old programs of not having any energy exchange and just wanting to give to wanting a massive energy exchange, you know, far beyond what's available.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my sentiment exactly. Just like, what do you do?
You know, but we're in a transition time, you know, and
yeah.
it's a time of trial and error, and just learning what works and creating a new kind of society. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we could really expect much else.
Yeah, that's what I say. We're trying to let it flow organically and come together and, you know, cross those bumps in the road as we go, and trying to create some kind of a unity consciousness here, you know, where we're all moving in the same direction, or we have a shared desire. It's tricky.
I think as far as, you know, creating unity consciousness, people have kind of this idea that creating unity consciousness is something that you would do in, you know, a meditation studio, mm-hmm. or something like that, because it's about consciousness, which mm-hmm. is something that happens in your head. But actually, only a little tiny part of it happens in your head. Mm-hmm. Most of it happens in the world and with your body. So mm-hmm. practically speaking, what does unity consciousness mean? It means community. Mm-hmm. Because a community is a group of people where other people's well-being affects your well-being directly, mm-hmm. which is different from, say, my neighborhood right here in semi-urban Harrisburg, where what happens to my next-door neighbor, who I barely even know, has no effect on my life because I don't depend on anything that he gives me. Mm-hmm. He could lose his job, he could get divorced, has no impact on me whatsoever. So I don't live in a community, at least in my neighborhood here. But in a community, if something bad or something good happens to somebody else in your community, communities are woven together with gifts. A community, you could even say, it's a group of people who give to each other and receive from each other, which means that, you know, maybe if we're in a community, I give to you, and you might not even give directly back to me, but you might give to somebody else who gives to somebody else, and eventually it circles back to me. So mm-hmm. if you have a stroke of bad fortune, then that's one less giver in the community. Or if you discover some great new talent, then the whole community is better off. Mm-hmm. And that's unity consciousness. It's the understanding that we are not separate, that what happens to you is happening to me, that your happiness is my happiness. It's an expansion of our sense of self. And so I think that you know, maybe you get it on an intellectual or spiritual level first, but then the desire to implement that more tangibly becomes unstoppable. Mm-hmm. And so we have this migration of this convergence of the spiritual people and the activists, mm-hmm. and you know, that we're trying to create actual manifestations of unity consciousness, which I would call community, and then there's an ecological dimension to it as well. But I think the kind of work that you're doing this is where it's at right now. It's how do we build a world on unity consciousness?
Mm-hmm. And there does seem to be, you know, in the beginning, when you're building a world like that, you are going to have an influx of funds and money to kick it off and to get it going, you know, and hopefully that money doesn't have hooks and controls on it and things like that. But eventually, you know, what eventually you want to get to a place that's self-sufficient, and that's either at least self-sufficient or creating abundance where it's running on its own. And, you know, mm-hmm. that's what we've been working towards here is it's kind of interesting because I have a sovereign group of rebels here, you know, uh-huh. trying to create unity consciousness. And, you know, the rebel energy is good. It's what broke them out of the program and the mold. But then pretty soon you're in a rebel pattern where you start rebelling against the things that are good or the things that you're trying to create. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting. So there's so many different dynamics going on here, and you know, there's got to be a way of uniting sovereign people, you know, where everybody's sovereign, but at the same time they're working for the whole, you know.
Well, you know, I think that we've been seeing kind of a progression of spiritual realizations or an evolution of consciousness to where it was once, not too long ago, the the new truth, the spiritual teaching was all that you need is within you. All the answers are within you. Look within. And that is becoming obsolete now. Mm-hmm. And the new spiritual truth is, I would call it, you know, spiritual interdependency. Or let's actually trigger ourselves and say spiritual dependency. It's the realization, I need you, mm-hmm. that I can't be complete without a community of people that can hold me in unity consciousness. It's not that some people can be in it and some can't, and the ones who are in it teach the ones who are not, but it's a transition that we have to undergo in groups, mm-hmm. I think. And I think that, you know, I've run into people like this speaking. One man, he said, I've got it all. I run a wellness center. I'm financially independent. I have a beautiful house, a loving marriage. And you know, what somebody thinks about me or that has no effect on me. You know, I'm content within. He said, but there's something missing. This was what I had aspired to, but it's not enough. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, when we talked about it, what came out is that what was missing was real community. Like, we have a need to need other people, or to recognize our need for other people. We just can't be happy without other people. Mm-hmm. And it's because that we are not these separate beings, these skin encapsulated egos. We are interbeings. We are our connections.
It's like a drop in the ocean, you know. It's mm-hmm. You know, we need the ocean, yeah. You know, and I guess we can be a drop or be the whole ocean. It all depends on consciousness and where you, how far you expand it out, or where you draw your boundaries.
I was thinking what you were saying about you know, that you need some kind of funding or money to get a project like yours started. And then the question of, you know, are there hooks attached, strings attached, and things mm-hmm. like that. And I've thought about that in the context of my book. Actually, I write about that in Sacred Economics a bit, that ultimately right livelihood comes down to gifts, and it has to do with the way that money is created in our system mm-hmm. as interest-bearing debt. So it gets lent into existence to people who are going to create even more of it, who are going to create more goods and services and sell those goods and services, which may not be a bad thing if those goods and services serve the good of society. But mm-hmm. in our current system, so many of them do not.
And you can, yeah.
You know, and really what the planet needs now isn't more goods and services. So ordinary investment isn't going to work for a project like yours, mm-hmm. which is actually trying to create fewer goods and services of the kind that are exchanged for money. You're not trying to convert your ecosystem into lumber. Mm-hmm. You're not trying to find things that people are doing for each other and stop them and sell them as services instead. But you're actually trying to encourage people to relearn skills that have been lost and to replace money functions with functions of service and other kinds of relationships. So what you are doing fundamentally isn't going to generate a profit for an investor. Mm-hmm. It's inescapable because you're not in the business of expanding humanity's domination of Earth and expanding the realm of property and turning nature into product. You're just not doing that. Therefore, anybody who funds a project like yours has to be doing it with no expectation of getting even more money back. In other words, it's a gift.
Mm-hmm. And I think the same goes for people joining the community. You can't come in with the old consciousness of high salaries and I'm going to cash in here or I'm going to, mm-hmm. You know, it's like, having, you know, big expectations, you know, that doesn't work either.
Right. Yeah, because you're not going to be you know, creating a branded service either. Mm-hmm. Because people aren't going to, and ultimately, even if you have retreats and some and things like that, the people who come there aren't going to be, the kind of retreats you're going to have aren't going to be the kind where, okay, we're going to get together and figure out how to make more money faster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're not going to have, Steve Jobs isn't going to be coming here, that's for sure. But we're not going to have, you know, people like that coming here and giving a lecture on the latest iPod, you know, or
right.
whatever else. And, you know, and actually, you know, get a portion of this, whatever sold, you know, or, I mean, there is some commerce, you know, people come and they give lectures, they sell their books, mm-hmm. You know, they get their book sales and they get, you know, whatever's worked out, you know, as far as a speaking fee or percentage. Mm-hmm. So that does go on, you know, but again, it's not trying to create again, a major corporation, mentality or a corporation program. You know, we're trying to get more into simplifying, you know, living simply mm-hmm. and living a really good life with what's really of value.
Yeah. Although I want to make clear to anyone who's listening that mm-hmm. that I'm not advocating the abolition of money, mm-hmm. But really what my book is about, it's about how to change money so that it's aligned with the things that are becoming sacred to us today. Mm-hmm.
Because today redirecting it.
Well, yeah, redesigning it. Mm-hmm. You know, how should money be created? Today it's created as interest-bearing debt. But that's not the only way to create money. There are other ways to bring money into being. And how money circulates and what the role of government is. And there's so many different ways that a money system could operate. And if we create it and circulate it and design it according to different principles, it could have a very different effect on society. Mm-hmm.
So I agree with that. Yeah, definitely. It's like I see it. It's right now. It you know, it is the accepted exchange of society. So we do have to function within that. You know, we can't build everything here from scratch. You know, so we definitely still have to function with money, but as I'm seeing now, the way it's set up now, the monetary system needs a total overhaul. Mm-hmm.
And it's collapsing too. Mm-hmm. You know, we're watching that happen kind of in slow motion.
Yeah, we're watching the rats leaving the ship right now. It seems like all the top bankers are disappearing and running to their retreats, you know, before their karma catches up with them.
But there's nowhere really for them to go.
Yeah.
You know, and that's also because we are connected beings. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can go to your gated community or your private island even, but mm-hmm. whatever's happening on Earth will find you there.
Yeah, they created their own jail, basically. You really think about it. You know, if you have a long trail of abuse, you know, to humanity and the Earth, no matter where you go, you know, that trail is going to catch up to you. And just by your nature, you're going to, you know, draw to you the lessons you need. Your soul is going to bring them to you for your own evolution. So, yeah, there is nowhere to hide. I mean, you can get your underground bunker and get your guards and everything else. But when the energy comes in, it's going to push up all your nonsense. And who would want to be underground with a bunch of tyrants? And control freaks. I mean, would you really want to be hanging out with those guys when you know, in the middle of these huge energy shifts that we're going through?
Yeah. Yeah, it's becoming more and more obvious that that the only security that you can have going into turbulent times comes from what you've given, mm-hmm. from the gratitude that you've created in the world around you, and not from what you can control. Even if you had bars of gold in your bunker to hire guards to prevent people coming and taking your gold, you know, and even if you're then, like, at some point the guards are going to say, hey, why don't we just take this guy's gold? Why should we use guards, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's not going to work.
No.
And this, I think that there is kind of a sense of it's a mixture of panic and fatalism that's infecting the power elite, mm-hmm. at least some portion of them. Some of them are still clinging to the pretense that everything's going to go back to normal, mm-hmm. but a lot of them are really seeing the writing on the wall. They don't necessarily know what to do about it, but they are not in control, not mm-hmm. in the way that kind of these conspiracy theories hypothesize that this is all going according to plan and so forth. The mood is one of kind of powerlessness,
yeah,
and responding to one unpredictable crisis after another and just buying a little time, hoping that in the 1 year before the next default, hoping that economic growth will rise again and we'll be able to grow ourselves out of debt. But this is a forlorn hope, mm-hmm. and the unpredictable nonlinear nature of reality is overwhelming all of the control mechanisms from that the power elite and whatever other entities you believe in can wield.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, my understanding of it comes from, you know, the vibrational lifting or, you know, the rising frequency of the earth, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, mm-hmm. you could just call it evolution. There's different names in it. But eventually, you know, that consciousness is no longer frequency specific. It's no longer acceptable or you know, that way is just it's just not going to be acceptable anymore in the future. So it's a dead end.
Yeah.
It can only implode and crash eventually. And basically the karma and the reaction, whatever you want to call it, is going to come back. It's just inevitable.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just don't, and that's what I see, you know, that old saying, man plans and God laughs, you know, I always think of that because these guys are very, very clever, but they're not wise because first of all, they haven't even figured out karma. And second of all, they haven't even figured out unity consciousness or the unified field. You know, any of the top physicists can tell you everything is connected. You know, there's nothing.
But, you know, I think it's really important to realize that on a deep level, those guys who don't get it, are ourselves. Like we're also those guys who don't get it.
Oh yeah.
I
used to be one of those guys. That's why I can say that.
But what I'm seeing though is that each person is pioneering a slightly different piece of the territory of mm-hmm. of unity, and that I find that if I really pay attention, I have something to learn from almost everybody that I meet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like everybody is kind of getting it in some different way, and that really this transition is a group phenomenon. That each one of us has something to learn and something to teach to everybody else.
Oh yeah, I get that even from the bugs.
You know? Yeah.
You know, I tell people you can, you know, just watch nature. You can even learn from the bugs. You know, look what they're doing. I mean, watch the ants. You know when you're going to have a hard winter. Just look how tall the anthill is. You know, watch how they work together. You know, and there's so many different things you can learn. And you know, in nature, sometimes you have to set boundaries. You know, if you got a hornet coming after you, you know, you might have to slap it down.
Yeah.
You know.
But I think it's quite PC today to say, yeah, we have a lot to learn from the ants and from nature. Mm-hmm. But when you say, well, we have a lot to learn, here's a banker who's, I'm going to talk to this man, he's a banker, mm-hmm. and he has $100 million in the bank, and do I have a lot to learn from him too? Or do I have anything to learn from him? Or is he just one of those people who doesn't get it, and he's less evolved, and mm-hmm. doesn't get unity consciousness, but I do? I think that attitude is itself the opposite of unity consciousness.
Well, he's got abundance down, and maybe he can start using that, you know.
And a lot of, you know, a lot of times, you know, you get somebody who's, well, like you were, you know, who has a change of heart for some reason. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I mean, there are people out there with tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars who want nothing other today anymore than to use those resources to create a more beautiful world. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people having that change of heart.
Yeah, I've I'm all for one of them dropping in on us, but we had a couple. Basically, we had some people here but you know, there's all these other dynamics involved in that, and
it's tricky. Yeah, there's so much attached to money. You know, they come in there and as soon as there's a lot of money involved, people begin to change.
Oh yeah,
and it brings out greed. You know, and it brings out all of these old wounds. So it's not so simple. Like if you're really wealthy, just to start throwing money at somebody.
Oh yeah,
like that sometimes can destroy a beautiful thing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're coming up the end of the hour, and I don't know if there's anything. You know, we're just got maybe less than a minute left, but I know we've got your website. Is that the best one for people to get a hold of you? Is that the Charles Eisenstein?
Go to charleseisenstein.net, and that has a portal to the other websites.
And there they can get your books and anything else they want to find out about.
And all my, there's tons of videos, books, recordings, and it's all available. You don't have to pay for it if you don't want to. And of course, you can also, you know, order the books in physical form through whatever bookstores. But it is also all available.
Great.
For free.
Yeah. Hey, well, I can't thank you enough for the work that you're doing on this planet and, you know, the new ideas that you're bringing to the table. And I'm sure we could probably do a 3-hour show with that one.
Yeah.
Anyway. But anyway, thank you so much for coming on the show. And we'll be in touch. You know, after I get through all this material, then I'll be able to go a little deeper into this.
Yeah. Thanks, James.
All right. Well, have a great day.
Yep. You too. Take care.
All right. Thanks again for listening, folks. I'm your host, James Gillen. We're signing off. Have a great day.